Muratov raised. Also, your response to those who suggested Alexei Navalny should have been awarded the prize and that Muratov was really a compromise by the Nobel Committee so as not to offend the Kremlin. He himself said Alexei Navalny should have gotten it.
So Alexei Navalny, I think, is, you know, he's an anti-corruption activist. He's also a political figure. I mean, he received 32% in the Moscow mayoral elections a few years ago. Novaya has covered the persecution of Alexei Navalny, very comprehensive coverage. But I do think of Navalny is not, he's an internet anti-corruption activist, and he also got very involved in the electoral scene in a way that Novaya steps back and reports, has its positions obviously, but is honest about them. So I think there should be a calling out of the repression of the Putin administration vis-a-vis journalists, but not attacking Novaya. Novaya has attacked foreign agent labeling, has stood for Navalny's rights to expose corruption. So I think that is misinformed, and in fact, I think it's an attempt to divide those who stand for, you know, press freedom. Navalny, Muratov. I will say Muratov is an extraordinary. He has retained a sense of humanity and humor.
We're going to have to leave it there. Katrina Vandenhoevel, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Governance and Policy Committee will meet on Wednesday, October 13th at 6 p.m. instead of the second Monday of this month. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify a meeting is being held.
Camera activist Betty Lee has captured 30 years of street protests in Portland, from the 1989 demonstration condemning the racist murder of Mulla Gaita Sirah to the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020. The Old Mole Variety Hour is pleased to offer a large print of your choice of Betty's most iconic photos to 10 lucky donors during KBOO's fall membership drive. Winners will be selected by lottery, and everyone who donates will be eligible. For more details and to see Betty's photos, go to kboo.fm/BETTELEE. Every Monday morning at 9 a.m., the Old Mole Variety Hour gnaws at the roots of our capitalist system with views, reviews, and interviews that you can sink your teeth into. Music by Lion Rhythms.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a one-hour special on Stokely Carmichael, also known as Kwame Ture. He is known by a generation for popularizing the cry of Black Power. We speak with Dr. Pinielle Joseph about his book, Stokely A Life. How did the concept of Black Power as a political strategy develop? How and why did Stokely Carmichael move from civil rights worker to U.S.-based Black Power leader to Pan-Africanist and socialist? What price did he pay? We have a wide-ranging conversation on Stokely's life, impact, and contributions. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. U.S. employers added just 194,000 jobs in September. It was a second month of tepid gains and evidence that the pandemic still has a grip on the economy, with many companies struggling to fill millions of open jobs. The report from the Labor Department also showed the official unemployment rate fell sharply to 4.8% from 5.2% in August. The government doesn't count people as unemployed unless they're actively looking for jobs. Analysts cite several reasons for the lack in employment. One is the high cost and the scarcity of childcare. Fear of COVID continues to keep some would-be job seekers on the sidelines, notably those who previously worked in public-facing service jobs at restaurants, bars, hotels, and retailers. The pandemic also caused an estimated 1.5 million older and wealthier workers to take retirement earlier than they otherwise would have. Many of them are likely to stay retired. The Senate voted last night to extend the government's borrowing authority into December. The party line vote of 50-48 came after 11 Republicans took part in an earlier vote to end debate and overcome a filibuster. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer faulted Republicans for the weeks of drama over whether the federal government would default on its debt.
Leader McConnell and Senate Republicans insisted they wanted a solution to the debt ceiling, but said Democrats must raise it alone by going through a drawn-out, convoluted, and risky reconciliation process. That was simply unacceptable to my caucus. And yesterday, Senate Republicans finally realized that their obstruction was not going to work.
After the Senate action, the number two House leader, Steny Hoyer, announced lawmakers would be called back to session Tuesday evening for the House vote to lift the federal borrowing cap. That debate will take place as lawmakers also work to fund the federal government for the new fiscal year and as they keep up their bitter battling over President Biden's top domestic priorities. A Taliban police official says at least 100 people were killed or wounded in a mosque explosion targeting Shiite Muslims in northern Afghanistan. There was no immediate claim for the suicide blast in the city of Kunduz, but self-styled Islamic State militants have a long history of attacking Afghanistan's Shiite Muslim minority. The IS militants have also targeted the Taliban in a series of deadly attacks, including shootings and an explosion at a mosque in the capital, Kabul. The 2021 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to journalist Maria Ressa of the Philippines and Dmitry Muratov of Russia. The Norwegian Nobel Committee cited their fight for freedom of expression, stressing that is vital in promoting peace. Berit Reiss-Andersen, chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, praised the work of the two crusading journalists.
They are representatives of all journalists who stand up for this ideal in a world in which democracy and freedom of the press face increasingly adverse conditions.
The Nobel Committee noted that Ressa in 2012 co-founded Rappler, which has focused critical attention on President Rodrigo Duterte's controversial, murderous anti-drug campaign in the Philippines. Ressa was convicted last year of libel and sentenced to jail in a decision seen as a major blow to press global freedom. Muratov was one of the founders in 1993 of the independent Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta. Since the early 2000s, six of its journalists and contributors have been killed in connection with their work, including Anna Politkovskaya. Her reporting exposed high-level corruption in Russia and human rights abuses in the Republic of Chechnya. A major abortion provider in Texas says it has resumed the procedure following a federal judge's ruling putting on hold the state law that effectively bans abortions. Whole Women's Health says it has reached out to patients it had on a waiting list to come in and have an abortion right away. The Texas Attorney General has appealed the judge's ruling. Crude oil from the fractured pipeline off the shore of Huntington Beach in Orange County has drifted at least 60 miles south to Oceanside and Carlsbad in San Diego County. Orange County Supervisor Katrina Foley announced the development.
It looks like there is now unexpectedly tar balls landing on the shores of Oceanside, as far down as Oceanside today. And they're looking at temporarily stopping operations at the Carlsbad desal plant because of inhaling oil sheens. So These are significant impacts.
Local and state lawmakers and environmentalists repeated their call for an offshore oil and gas drilling ban for the entire state of California. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. We focus this hour on the life and impact of Stokely Carmichael, also known by his African name, Kwame Ture. Let's hear an excerpt from Stokely Carmichael's 1966 speech at the University of California, Berkeley.
Now then, in order to understand white supremacy, we must dismiss the fallacious notion that white people can give anybody their freedom. No man can give anybody his freedom. A man is born free. You may enslave a man after he is born free. And that is, in fact, what this country does. It enslaves black people after they're born. So that the only act that white people can do is to stop denying black people their freedom. That is, they must stop denying freedom. They never give it to anyone. Now, we want to take that to its logical extension so that we could understand then what its relevancy would be in terms of new civil rights bills. I maintain that every civil rights bill in this country was passed for white people, not for black people. For example, I am black. I know that. I also know that while I am black, I am a human being. Therefore, I have the right to go into any public place. White people didn't know that. Every time I tried to go into a place, they stopped me. So some boys had to write a bill to tell that white man he's a human being. Don't stop him. That bill was for that white man, not for me. I knew it all the time. I knew that I could vote, and that wasn't a privilege, it was my right. Every time I tried, I was shot, killed, or jailed, beaten, or economically deprived. So somebody had to write a bill for white people to tell them, when a black man comes to vote, don't bother him. That bill, again, was for white people, not for black people. So that when you talk about open occupancy, I know I can live any place I want to live. It is white people across this country who are incapable of allowing me to live where I want to live. You need a civil rights bill, not me. I know I can live where I want to live.
Dr. Peniel Joseph is a professor of history at Tufts University and the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. He is the author of the book, Stokely: A Life, a biography of iconic civil rights leader Stokely Carmichael. Dr. Joseph is also the author of the award-winning Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America, and Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Dr. Peniel Joseph stopped by our studios when he was in Los Angeles on his book tour. Here is what the New York Times had to say about Stokely: A Life. They say, quote, in chronicling the life of the activist intellectual Stokely Carmichael in Stokely: A Life, an insightful, highly engaging, and fluently written biography, the historian Peniel E. Joseph has shed light on one critical, if largely overlooked, part of that journey. And there you have a rather glowing review by the New York Times. It's entitled Evolution of an Activist. Let's go to our interview now with Dr. Peniel Joseph. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Margaret.
All righty. So, Stokely: A Life, book about Stokely Carmichael. What got you interested in doing a book on Stokely?
Well, I mean, my mother is really my first teacher and historian and mm-hmm. really an activist. And I'm the son of Haitian immigrants
who came
to the United States in 1965. So I was raised by a single mother in New York City. And she worked for Mount Sinai Hospital and was part of the 1199 Hospital Workers Union. So I was on my first picket line when I was in elementary school. So,
but we have a kind of a similar story because I'm also from the islands, from Barbados,
yes.
and emigrated to Brooklyn,
yep.
and, you know, got involved in the movement from there.
Yeah, right? And we actually lived in Brooklyn and then moved to Queens.
Oh, okay.
So it's a very interesting story as well. Yeah.
Crown Heights in Brooklyn.
And we were off of Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn.
Yeah. I used to live on Eastern Parkway at some point. Yeah.
And so I got interested in political activism through my mother. So I was reading about Haitian history and the Black Jacobins by C.L.R. James when I was 10 years old. So Stokely Carmichael came into my consciousness at a very, very young age, and it got reinforced through the Eyes on the Prize television series, which was Henry Hampton, the African-American executive producer of that. That's coming out of Boston's Black Side Productions, and journalists like Callie Crossley and others were working on that. And so Stokely became part of my education in terms of the civil rights movement. And as I grew up into high school, was very, very active, college, very, very active around many different issues, including Haitian refugees in Guantanamo, anti-death penalty work. Al Sharpton was there, Sonny Carson, all these different activists in New York. And so Stokely became somebody who I was pursuing. People talked about Malcolm X, Dr. King, but Stokely really came into my consciousness. And so through doing work on the Black Power movement, I went to Temple University for my PhD. This was around the time that there was really a lot of activism around Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was on death row, former Black Panther, around welfare rights, Kensington welfare rights activism in and around Philadelphia, especially North Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. You know, I taught high school in Philadelphia while doing my PhD. So Stokely was always, you know, in the back of my mind, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture. And I got a chance to see Kwame Ture in Philadelphia when he gave a speech at University of Pennsylvania before he was diagnosed with cancer. So he was hugely charismatic. He was talking about imperialism. He was talking about capitalism. He was talking about racial oppression. And I got the chance to see him, shake his hand, briefly speak to him. And then when I was doing my dissertation, I did a dissertation on the Black Power movement. And that turned into my first book, which was called Waiting Till the Midnight Hour. And the deeper I did research, the more I was interested in Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture.
Right. And of course, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame, who later changed his name to Kwame Ture, born in Port of Spain in Trinidad and Tobago, also hailed from the Caribbean. So you were kind of grounded in that experience in your youth with your mom, labor union, Black Power movement as a student activist, you know, et cetera. So getting more into the book itself and the life of Stokely Carmichael, of course, a very controversial, you know, figure. And a lot of people remember, of course, he's mainly remembered for his cry of Black Power. And various other people have also staked the claim on coming up, you know, with that term. There are lots of stories I hear in the movement, you know, around that. But tell us then about Stokely's early years, his formative years then, as he becomes more of a national leader, but prior to that.
Well, yeah, he's born June 29th, 1941 in Port of Spain, Trinidad. And what's interesting is that Stokely's parents both leave for the United States when he's really a tiny baby. Mm. And so he's raised by his paternal grandmother, Cecilia, and he's raised by his aunts as well, right? So he's really the middle child of five. He's the only boy. He's the only son. He's really going to be somebody who is always identifying with underdogs, even in Trinidad. Even as a young man, he's a sharp dresser. They call him Little Man. He's in the little suits that his all these strong Black women who are raising him dress him in. He goes to a little intermediary school on the island in Port of Spain, Trinidad. He's hugely precocious, hugely smart and intelligent. He always remembers Trinidad because he leaves Trinidad 2 weeks before his 11th birthday, but he's inculcated in both the Caribbean tradition, but also the British tradition, right? He remembers when Princess Margaret comes to the island and he's waving the flag at 10 years old. This is a memory that he's later going to say he's embarrassed by the time he's in London in 1967. He's looking at a portrait of Princess Margaret, and he's saying, why is everybody so obsessed with British royalty? But he used to be, too, as just a young boy. He comes to New York City in 1952, and what's interesting is he's reunited with his family after not seeing his mother for 6-7 years, after not seeing his father. So he has to get reacclimated. Him and his sisters come back to New York City, and there's two more sisters that have been born while they were still in Trinidad. So what's interesting is the Carmichael clan gets reunited, and they move to the Morris Park section of the Bronx. His father, Adolphus Carmichael, who's a carpenter who had built the house he grew up in Trinidad, is really now a jack of all trades, a taxi cab driver. His mother, Mae Charles, is a homemaker but a firebrand. She's the one who Stokely takes his temperament really after. And so what's interesting is that he moves to a predominantly white section of the Bronx, predominantly Italian. His friends become predominantly white, predominantly Italian. He goes to Bronx Science High School. He tests into that school. That's a very competitive school to test into.
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. Predominantly Jewish school. And what's interesting is that he really becomes part of multiple worlds. On one level, he's got the Caribbean background. On another level, he's running with this predominantly Italian kids in his neighborhood. He's also going to Harlem, where he's getting his hair cut, and he's hearing street speakers in Harlem, including Nation of Islam, but street speakers who are talking about the African Revolution in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. He's hearing about Emmett Till. Emmett Till is assassinated and lynched in 1955, 14-year-old black boy from Chicago, lynched in Money, Mississippi. Stokely is the same age as Emmett Till when Emmett Till is lynched. So he's hearing about the civil rights movement. He's hearing about Malcolm X, and he's also participating in left-wing study groups where they're reading Marxism, they're reading socialism. Now, the black socialist tradition is going to be very, very important for the young Stokely Carmichael because he's going to be introduced to Bayard Rustin. Mm-hmm. And Bayard Rustin is the leading black socialist along with A. Philip Randolph in the United States. And what's interesting about Bayard Rustin is that Rustin belongs to a black radical social democratic tradition, a tradition of activism, organizing, pacifism. He had been incarcerated for being a conscientious objector during World War II. He had visited Africa. He had visited India. He schooled, mentored Martin Luther King Jr. in Montgomery, Alabama. Rustin was also openly homosexual, so he was also on the margins of the movement because of being arrested on morals charges. When Stokely first sees Bayard Rustin, he asks, who is that speaking at a rally? He's told that that's Bayard Rustin, the socialist, and he says, that's who I want to be. So mm-hmm. he's gonna have all these different streams of activism. I should add that he's also organizing in Harlem as a teenager. So before he joined SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Stokely Carmichael is political. He's politicized, but he's also global. One of the things we have to remember with Stokely, he doesn't discover Pan-Africanism in the 1960s. He was in a Pan-African context in the 1950s.
He was grounded in it, part of his education.
Absolutely.
Political education.
He's listening to Miriam Makeba as a teenager, and he tells one of his sisters that he's going to marry her as a teenager.
Right. Yeah. So that's quite something. And I guess that continues in a kind of a radical tradition that a number of us who've come from the Caribbean region, Dr. Gerald Horn writes a bit about a kind of a clandestine organization of Caribbean radicals.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually, yeah. And so who knows, you know, if there was any, if it was open or not, you know, a connection with Stokely and that particular trend.
And you know, I think what's interesting about being from the Caribbean is that, and we see it, whether it's Marcus Garvey or Hubert Harrison, is that there's such a rich connection between the Caribbean, the United States, but also Africa. So it's a rich Pan-African cultural, political connection. These folks are activists and intellectuals, and Stokely is coming out of that tradition.
Right, and grounded in a much a broader international view. Okay, so jumping ahead then, he does all of this, and he winds up being a freedom writer in the South.
He winds up being a freedom writer. He goes to Howard University. What's interesting, he joins the Nonviolent Action Group, which is a SNCC affiliate at Howard University. At Howard University, it's really important to remember that the professors at Howard University include Sterling Brown, the towering poet, Toni Morrison, the future Pulitzer and Nobel Prize winner, is his freshman English professor.
Amazing.
There are so many different, E. Franklin Frazier, the towering sociologist. So when we think about Howard, the Howard that Stokely Carmichael goes to from 1960 to 64 has a better faculty in my mind than Harvard University or any university in the United States. So we have to think of Howard not as just the black school, but as this towering, intellectually gigantic school with so many different luminaries. And he's also connecting with so many different young civil rights activists, people like Ed Brown, Courtland Cox, Mike Thelwell, Hank Thomas. There's going to be so many different people. So he becomes a freedom rider. He's part of SNCC. He's organizing in D.C., but he meets up with John Lewis. And Stokely gets arrested for the first time in Mississippi as a freedom rider June 8, 1961. He spends about 40 days in Parchman Penitentiary, Mississippi's worst prison farm. And he's going to be incarcerated with people like James Farmer of CORE, John Lewis of SNCC as well. And he spends his 20th birthday in jail. And that's going to be the first of many birthdays that he spends in jail. So what's interesting about Stokely in the early 1960s is that that visit to Mississippi sparked something in him. He's going to visit Mississippi every summer afterwards, and in 1964 go and live in Mississippi after graduating from Howard University. Bob Moses also inspires him. Bob Moses is the SNCC activist who really goes to, initially in 61, Macomb, Mississippi. And there's the beautiful letter that Moses smuggles out of a jail in Macomb, Mississippi, along with 13 SNCC activists in 1961, where he calls Mississippi the middle of the iceberg. And the iceberg is a metaphor for white supremacy and Jim Crow and racial oppression in the United States. And what's interesting is Stokely really, Bob Moses becomes Stokely's hero. He meets up with Moses in 1962. Part of the reason he changes his major from pre-med to philosophy is because of Bob Moses, and they spend time discussing philosophical questions. And so Stokely falls in love with Mississippi. And so when we think about between 60 and 64, he's at Howard University. He's organizing in Cambridge, Maryland with Gloria Richardson and other activists. He's organizing Route 40 demonstrations with Julius Hobson and CORE activists. He's being influenced by Ella Baker, who's the founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And really, Ella Baker's key here because she convinces the young people who are part of SNCC that what they're doing, there's more than meets the eye in terms of what they're doing. Her famous speech in 1960 that it's about more than just a hamburger. She's saying that it's about nothing less than democracy and radicalizing and transforming all these systems of oppression in the United States. Even if a senior civil rights leaders like Dr. King, who's only 8, 9, 10 years older than them, disagree. So there's all these influences, Fannie Lou Hamer, Annie Ponder, all these different black women who are also influencing his activism in the Delta. Stokely becomes hugely, hugely popular, not just at Howard, but anywhere he goes. Among older black people in the Delta, he adopts their folk ways. He's hugely deferential to seniors. He babysits children. He eats whatever food is in front of him. He's hugely respectful. So it's very, very important to understand that he thinks of poor black sharecroppers and poor black people as the people that can save democracy in the United States.
Yeah, and also I imagine with his roots in the Caribbean, much more rural than in the United States. I mean, when you go south and a lot of those old ways and respect for the elders and you eat your food in front of you, I mean, all of those are things that transfer over from others of us in the diaspora. I want to dig in a little bit with the time in SNCC because the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, because you have SNCC, you've got King's Organization, SCLC, you've got the Congress of Racial Equality, you have the NAACP, the oldest civil rights organization in the country, but has this history, I guess, of being more, you know, more of the conservative, more mainstream than some of the others. And we do know that there were tensions and power struggles among them. Mm-hmm. But Stokely developed a close relationship with Martin Luther King. Tell us, you know, a bit about that, because that really played a big role in how in his view, how he was seen and also how other people see him.
Yeah, he first meets up with Dr. King in 1963 at Howard University. Mm-hmm. And unlike other SNCC activists, Stokely puts his ego aside when it comes to King. So when people in the rural Delta ask him if he's one of King's men, he says yes. He doesn't get into an explanation. He's very impressed by Dr. King's love of black people and their love of King. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that is because he aspires to the same thing. Because King, even though he's this man of letters and he's born in the black middle class, in a way, King commits a kind of class suicide and class rejection by really identifying with the least of these. And Stokely does the same thing. So when we think about King and Stokely, they meet in 63. Stokely serves as his chauffeur in 1964 in Greenwood. They march together in Selma in 65, which is sort of a little known fact. And Stokely moves into Lowndes County with SNCC and don't go to the main Selma demonstration. They use that demonstration to burrow deep into Lowndes County to do their independent political organizing. And they become really close along the Meredith March in 1966. They spent about 3 weeks together. In subsequent years, you know, King invites Stokely to his home in Atlanta for dinner. They speak on the phone together. They headline a major anti-war demonstration April 15th, 1967, where there's 400,000 people there. So Stokely impacts King and King impacts Stokely. I think the thing that King does for Stokely is really let him become more pragmatic and more patient in a lot of ways. He sees that Dr. King really, really loves black people, and whatever King is trying to do is because of that love. And I think Stokely always credits Dr. King with teaching him and other black people how to face racial terror without fear. That's what he says, right? Stokely impacts King just through his radicalism, his speaking truth to power, his vocal and robust anti-war activism. He teases King the night of April 15th, 1967 at Harry Belafonte's apartment. And Harry Belafonte is huge here, you know, civil rights activist, legendary freedom fighter. And they're at his apartment in New York. And Stokely's teasing King, who had come out against Vietnam 11 days earlier at the Riverside Church, mm-hmm. and saying that, you know, you're coming out against the war because of me.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that a couple of weeks later, King calls up Stokely and says that he wants him to come to Ebenezer Baptist last mm-hmm. Sunday in April, and he wants him to hear him speak, preach. And Stokely says, you know, I'm not coming because I'm not going to be doing the Lord's work. I'm doing the people's work like a good heathen.
Yeah.
And King implores him. Stokely says, why? King says he's going to be speaking out against Vietnam. And Stokely said he's going to be in the front row of that pew. And we've got great footage from Eyes on the Prize that shows Stokely mm-hmm. Carmichael alongside of Cleve Sellers, who's his best friend,
yeah.
SNCC activist too, leading the standing ovation after King really comes out against the war that last Sunday in April at Ebenezer.
Right, and I want to dig in a little bit with this as well, because James Meredith, of course, a student who was shot, had started a march on his own, and then it grew. Other people joined in, and the Meredith March that you referred to, letting our audience know what that was. But also, some of the tensions, you know, within the movement emerged somewhat within that march, because some of the mainstream leaders didn't want to participate at first, but also that Stokely, who was an organizer, used the march for his own devices. I mean, other people might have had one idea of what they wanted to do with the march, but Stokely, the organizer, wanted to really use the occasion of the march and also his friendship with King, which gave him, you know, a certain amount of cred, right, in the movement.
No, absolutely.
So the march was kind of dual purposed in a way.
Yes, that becomes the last unified civil mm-hmm. rights demonstration of the 60s. But SNCC and Stokely really utilize King and the King's presence, which attracts all that media,
right.
Although King is not there that night of June 16th, to really unleash the black power phrase. So this is all strategic. This is definitely mm-hmm. strategic. For them, black power is going to be the radical, social, political, cultural self-determination that's required to initially first get democracy and citizenship in the United States, and eventually a political revolution once they figure that these democratic institutions will never work the way they're claiming they're going to work.
Right. And all
democratic institutions working the way they're supposed to work. Please support your community connection, KBOO Portland, as we are in the last week of our fall drive, supporting the sounds of democracy, our efforts to make the democratic institutions work just how they should work. You can text KBOO to 44321 or go to kboo.fm/give and donate now. We want to thank William Jolliffe. We want to thank Carol A. We want to thank Robert L., William J., Beth P., Michael L., Tom C., David M., and Judith M. for supporting your KBOO here in Portland.
Also, the organizing that happened during the march, I mean, along the way, and the various stops along the way of various confrontations, you know, with the police and, you know, just the organizing of local communities, which was really an important aspect of the movement at that time.
Oh,
and the march helped to achieve that.
Yeah, they're going to register about 4,000 people. They're going to go into the Delta where people are picking cotton and take people with them. Small towns with names like Grenada, Belzoni, so many different little places in the Delta where they're organizing people, they're registering people to vote for the first time since Reconstruction. So genuine organizing is taking place there. Initially, Whitney Young and Roy Wilkins balk at this, and they balk at the fact that the Meredith March Manifesto.
They were the Urban League.
Urban League and NAACP. Urban League eventually is going to come back to the table. They balk at this because the Meredith March Manifesto, one that King approves of, is very critical of Lyndon Johnson. And the Meredith March also wants very tangible policy. They want more protection for voters. They want more registrars there to register people to vote. And they want Justice Department protection for civil rights workers.
Yeah, and interestingly also it was Black Power in action, because there were the confrontations that happened when the marchers were supposed to stay, let's say, in a black, you know, school grounds and were stopped from doing it. And then local people who perhaps for the first time ever, you know, really had to stand up to authorities and to the police. So it would, the march also lent that kind of grassroots Black Power in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the McNeil Elementary School is where Stokely was supposed to put up the tent, and he gets arrested there because they have received permission from the black officials, but then they're overruled by white officials. And what's interesting is there's going to be huge violence in Canton, Mississippi, where marchers are going to be routed by state troopers who were initially there to protect them. But once they start to set up a camp, there's going to be tear gas. Stokely's going to be hit in the chest with a canister. King is going to be there. There's going to be real disarray. King is going to call that violence worse than Selma. And I think a real denouement 2 years after Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman are killed, King, along with Stokely Carmichael, returns to Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is the site of the assassination of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman.
Three civil rights workers killed
during the Freedom Summer. And Stokely says that, you know, there's all these racist mobs there. And Stokely says that this is the face of a sick and resisting society that pays lip service to democracy. That's what he tells them in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
We're going to take a quick station break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Say it loud.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We now continue our discussion with Dr. Piniel Joseph. He has a book, Stokely Alife. And, of course, Stokely Carmichael, known by a generation for popularizing the cry of Black Power, but also developing the politics behind that cry. And our guest is Dr. Piniel Joseph. So you have the Freedom Riders, Freedom Summer, of course, so many of the Northern, especially, but not only white students going to the South. Goodman Cheney Schwerner killed. Cheney, of course, being tortured as well. Yes. There's evidence of that that has now emerged. So Stokely is now as in SNCC, part of SNCC, very well known in SNCC. He gets elected. But that election was a bit controversial because he didn't get elected in the first round.
He didn't get elected in the first round. Worth Long, a SNCC activist, is going to say that it needs to be re-voted on procedural grounds because not everybody had a chance to vote. So John Lewis is replaced by Stokely Carmichael as chairman. And that's really going to end their friendship for a time. And really thrust SNCC into a different direction because Stokely is so charismatic, and coupled with the Black Power speech, really a month and a half later, he's going to be this national iconic figure and also fill the vacuum that was left after Malcolm X's assassination February 21st, 1965. So in a way, when you think about Stokely's trajectory, by 66, 67, 68, he is a national and global icon in his own lifetime. Receiving more attention than Malcolm did while Malcolm was alive. Mm-hmm. So Stokely's international trips and Stokely's political activities are followed by the major government agencies and the media and different institutions and organizations in really a different way. So it's very interesting when we think about the way in which this time unfolds by 66, 67, 68. You know, what a huge figure he becomes.
Yeah, and that is still being debated among SNCCers, as they call it today. You know, I know my cousin Martha Prescott, who was in SNCC and definitely one of the Stokely, you know, supporters in that. But there were some tensions as a result of not only that particular vote and John Lewis and the breaking with John Lewis and Stokely, but also Stokely then becoming a national figure and what that meant for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee as an organization, of course, in its latter days. But moving on, he clearly became of great interest to the media, of great interest to U.S. intelligence also, which continued, I think, likely until the rest of his life, it seemed. But I felt in reading the book and from my memories also of that time, there's a way in which what happened to Stokely and his evolution explained a lot of what was going on in the movement generally, because there really were those debates. I mean, there was the rise of Malcolm X, people in SNCC very much attracted to Malcolm X's more militant message as opposed to King's turn the other cheek, you know, message. The rise of the Black Panther Party, the Nation of Islam, then the split that happened within the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X, you know, for example. And there were some of the decisions and some of the decisions that Stokely made and some of the moments in his life, I guess, reflected his humanness in a way and kind of which way am I really going? You know what I mean? Because there are a lot of people who were quite stuck and still remain stuck on, for example, Minister Farrakhan's role in criticizing Malcolm X after he left the Nation, but yet Stokely developed quite a close relationship with Minister Farrakhan. You know, so there were all those kinds of intricacies that have a lot to do with what happened with the civil rights movement, what happened with the Black Power movement.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's a lot of different debates and different disputes that are going on, and certainly Stokely is a part of that. I think that the relationship with Farrakhan is because he believes in a Black United Front. But I think what's interesting about Stokely and his evolution in the late 60s is really the way in which, really in a large way, we call him a revolutionary Pan-Africanist. But when we think about Black Power and what he's doing, he's both that and he's this anti-imperialist. I mean, what happens to him by, you think about the Berkeley speech, October of 1966. Mm-hmm. That's an anti-imperialist speech before he goes to Puerto Rico, before he goes to Cuba, Algiers. He's talking about white skin privilege, white supremacy. He says democracy is not real in the United States, that the war in Vietnam is a racist war. He says that, you know, the United States doesn't have a conscience. King's message can only work with people who do have that. And he's saying that's his difference with King. Not the message, just the fact that America is an empire and can't listen to this message. So what's interesting is his anti-Vietnam War protest and him going to Puerto Rico, him going to London, the Dialectics of Liberation Conference, where Angela Davis sees him, him going to Cuba, you know, a million people, Fidel Castro and Santiago saying, this is the Black revolutionary leader of the United States. Him going to Algiers, where he's with the FLN and the Algerian revolutionaries. Him going to, you know, Conakry, Guinea, where he meets up with Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, Miriam Makeba. He goes to Tanzania and meets up with Julius Nyerere, but representatives of the ANC and other different revolutionary organizations. He goes to Copenhagen, meets up with Jean-Paul Sartre. He's in Stockholm. He's in Paris, right? All this is very, very transformative and heady. And by the time he comes back to the United States, he's prime minister of the Black Panther Party, popularizing that. Mm-hmm. So he becomes really, very, very broadly speaking, somebody whose politics and his intellectual ideas are very, very generative. He leaves the United States a radical political activist. I argue that he comes back really a revolutionary and devoting, ready to devote his life to what he sees as this global political revolution that's necessary to defeat what he calls American empire, right? So there's this anti-capitalism, anti-imperialism. For him, revolutionary Pan-Africanism is the vehicle to get to that, right?
Right.
And so many people are moving. He really anticipates the Pan-African turn, but his Pan-Africanism is very specific. Some are going to say sectarian because it's Nkrumahism, Touréism, where you think about somebody like Amiri Baraka, Congress of African People, it's sort of a larger, more expansive, we're going to let these people in. With Stokely, soon to be Kwame Touré, his vision, his revolutionary vision is based on a specific political faith. He talks about scientific socialism, but it's a very specific vision and interpretation of Africa and African history, which he's getting from Nkrumah, he's getting from Touré.
Right, and learning some tough lessons, because when he left the U.S., and I remember a lot of people at the time, I was like, what? Okay, he left the U.S. and made these international connections as you, and built those connections as you so rightly outlined. But then coming back to the U.S., clearly something had shifted. And the level of media interest, the level of power even within the Black community that he was so connected to before leaving the U.S. had somewhat waned. I mean, he wasn't received in the same way as he was Stokely, you know, raising the fist for Black Power and the Black Panther Party. I mean, even when he went south, returned to the South, except, of course, when he went to Washington, D.C. and Howard University, the red carpet was always rolled out for him. So I imagine that was a tough political lesson on the one hand, and on the other hand, Nkrumah's vision of African unity and the unification of Africa, and what happened in Guinea, and creeping what some would call sectarianism.
Yes.
Coming in. So he's really straddling a lot of worlds and seems to be, I mean, doing it as well as he could, I imagine. But he really was in a quandary for a while there.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we see there is certainly there is sectarianism. By the time you're saying, you know, your specific ideology is the only way to unite Africa, that's sectarianism. Black Power was more capacious and expansive. I think the difference when we think about Stokely Carmichael and the evolution to Kwame Touré, Stokely was asking all these questions, right? He was asking all these questions and admitted that he didn't have the answers. You know, as Kwame Touré, he's saying he has the answers through, you know, the All African People's Revolutionary Party, the political thought of Nkrumah. Nkrumah dies in 1972, and then sort of the state leadership of of Sekou Touré, because he becomes connected to Sekou Touré, him and Miriam Makeba. So he's under sort of the protection of Sekou Touré. So there's not necessarily going to be a critique of the state of Guinea and really of different African autocrats, right? And, you know, for him, I think he's rationalizing that because there's this larger fight against imperialism that must take place, right? Yeah. For others, there's going to be a really criticism and say, these are political blinders, Kwame Ture, that you have that you refuse to see. And certainly leaving the United States, I think any political leader who leaves their adopted country, you're going to lose a kind of power and prestige because you're no longer living there.
And popular base.
And popular base, you mm-hmm. know. But I think one of the reasons he left, I think he's very, very skeptical of what happened to people like Marion Barry, what happened to people like Jesse Jackson. He saw that not so much as a betrayal of the revolution, but just as not the right direction to take.
Like it was the rise of the black political class.
Rise of the black political class. So he could have, you know, become Stokely Carmichael, mayor of some place, right?
Yeah.
But he didn't want that. He believed in revolution, that capitalism and the contradictions of capitalism in terms of lack of access to health care, poverty, prisons, all of that needed to be eradicated. And you know, I think he had tried in his own way to do it through local politics in Mississippi and Lowndes County, Alabama. And he said, look, that won't work. So what's interesting about him compared to other activists who might have a critique of electoral mm-hmm. politics. He had organized with people for electoral politics. He had organized for voting rights. He had lived and worked with some of the poorest people in America. And he said that didn't work in the way in which we had anticipated. So what he was doing, and sometimes you think of it as sort of politics on high, you know, you're with, you know, mm-hmm. Nkrumah and Touré, and you're sort of jet setting, was a way. His argument was Africa was our only natural land base. It was the only land base we could protect. So if you had a unified Africa, one nation, one army, one leader, that would provide leverage for black liberation in the United States, the Caribbean, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and I want to return to his time in Africa, but really we have to set one story straight. So we have to go back a little bit within SNCC having to do with women. Because we all heard, the whole nation heard, Stokely said the role of women in the revolution is to be prone, right? So let's get that story straight of what really happened.
Well, yeah, that goes back to November 1964 in Waveland, Mississippi at a mm-hmm. SNCC conference where there's a then anonymous position paper on the role of women that has since been attributed to Casey Hayden, who was married to Tom Hayden
in the
early 60s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Mary King, who
right.
in her memoir really recalls how after that meeting, they're on a pier in Waveland, Mississippi, and they're talking and laughing and people are joking. Because you remember, these people are 21, 22 years old,
yeah.
18, 19 years old. So they're kids. And somebody says, mentions something about the position of women in SNCC. And Stokely gets up and does a kind of little stand-up routine, which he often did. He imitated people like King. He would imitate
Lyndon
Johnson.
Kind of a comedy thing, yeah.
Comedy thing. And he says, the position of women in SNCC, and he pauses for effect, and he says, is prone. And everybody starts laughing. So it's a joke that, yes, it's a sexist joke among friends, among people who might have been college classmates. That has since been decontextualized and took on a life of its own.
It sure did.
But when you talk to mm-hmm. women in SNCC, they'll say that Stokely was among the most responsive men in SNCC.
Mm-hmm.
And it also makes it seem as if SNCC was this organization rife with sexism. Doesn't mean there was no sexism in SNCC, but certainly one of the things that women, and there's a great anthology by Judy Richardson et al., Hands on the Freedom Plow, about black and white women in SNCC, is they talk about how transformative that experience was, and how, in terms of gender equity, SNCC didn't mirror the huge, enormous patriarchy that was felt and misogyny on the outside, right? Doesn't mean that there was none of that, but it just means that, you know, black women and white women in SNCC had enormous self-determination and exhibited enormous abilities and tenacity. So that wasn't the kind of things and treatment that was accepted within SNCC at all.
Yeah, and Hands in the Freedom Plow, put together by a number of SNCC women,
yes.
Judy being one of them. So I just had to get that out there.
Yes.
So then we move forward again to the complexities, really, of the time in Africa, because Sekou Touré, starting out as a revolutionary, Guinea, the country becoming, at least it's been reported to be becoming increasingly repressive against, you know, people who are opposition,
yes,
to the government. And Stokely always appeared with his button, you know, and very loyal to that regime. They hosted him and his wife, Miriam Makeba. Another controversial thing is his visit to Uganda, the invitation by Idi Amin. Mm-hmm. And practically by then, the whole world knew about the controversies around Idi Amin. So how did Stokely himself see what looked to other people as a contradiction? You are revolutionary, but yet you're kind of consorting with people who perhaps may have started out as in a revolutionary way, but have since betrayed the revolution. I mean, how do you see that he balanced that or justified it?
Well, I think he looked at it as a couple of things. One, he believed in a very overarching vision of black solidarity about not publicly criticizing black people ever. You know, I think that that can constrain your politics and be a major mistake. Two, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So the idea that Idi Amin and other African dictators who at least both real and paid lip service to anti-imperialism, and for what Stokely was very important, anti-Zionism.
You know, right, and support for the Palestinian people.
Support for the Palestinian people. So what's interesting there is I think that these are errors. I think that these are mistakes. I mean, historical icons and leaders can make mistakes. They often do, right? But for him, he rationalized and justified that by saying that who is the United States to provide any kind of moral barometer for anyone? That was always his argument. His argument was that, you know, whether it was President Richard Nixon or others, hadn't they illegally surveilled people like him? Hadn't they been
bombed and killed a whole set of folks
in Vietnam and Cambodia, right? So who was the United States to tell anybody about morality, right? That's the argument. But of course, I mean, by the time you're trying to play politics up on high, it gets very, very messy. Lowndes County and the Delta, it's a clearer, simpler political picture, right? That these are folks being oppressed and we need to stop this oppression. By the time you're saying you're aligning yourself with any state power, including the United States, right? I think, you know, whether you're president of the United States or you're the head of another country, Africa or the third world, you're making all kinds of political calculations that are no longer as simple as black and white. And I think that's what he found himself in. But certainly I think he, as an older, more mature activist, he found himself in positions that I think his younger self would have definitely questioned and criticized.
Yeah, and by the time he fell ill and dying at way too young an age, 57 in 1998, he seemed to have come full circle as people who allegedly disagreed with him politically, who really gathered around him and supported him during the time that he was ill. I can't believe how the clock is going, because there's so much more we need to talk about. Dr. Beniel Joseph, the author of Stokely, A Life. So we're going to have to continue the conversation. But just finally, because I know you have to dash, I think it's great that you did this book and you did the research, because it is true when we look back at the movement, and I think we of that period, and we do have to do it, right? So history doesn't repeat itself. And you do, there's a lot of talk about King. There's a lot of talk, of course, about increasingly about Malcolm X, because I don't think he has, you know, he's been given his due yet as well, Malcolm X. But Stokely did play an important role in all of that. And it really is important to see his evolution and all of the challenges that meet people who are trying to change the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's a great example of a well-lived life, because we've turned this idea of success and money and wealth and fame at all costs into the only model of having a well-lived life, right? Stokely Carmichael Kwame Ture, it's a life of political struggle, and it's a life of victories, but also defeats as well, and shortcomings, right? But he always believes in justice and revolution and the end of all forms of oppression for everyone, long past the expiration date in the American imagination and even in the global imagination, that things could get better and that, again, Goliaths could be defeated, and that you know, racism, economic injustice, inequality, all those things could be ended in our lifetimes. He continued to believe, and that's why he answered the phone ready for revolution.
Yeah, and from a young man up until the time he died, practically every day working for what he believed in that would change the world. On that note, I'm so sorry that we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Romero Funes, our assistant producer, and today's audio engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives.
You are listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 in Points East along the Columbia River Gorge. In Philomath, Oregon, it is 104.3, and everywhere, KBOO.FM. If you've enjoyed this program, and we hope you did, please support us in the middle, the end of our fall membership drive. If you've already become a member, invite somebody else, friend or family, to become a member. It's very easy. You can go to kboo.fm/give. Or you can text for your donation, KBOO, the letters KBOO, to 44321, and make your donation that way. Don't forget to check out our shirt. The shirt exemplifies the voices of democracy, the sound of democracy, the resonance of democracy here on Your Community Connection, KBOO, Portland.
Or go online to PacificaRadioArchives.org. And remember to visit our website at SoTrueRadio.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our handle there, at SoTrueRadio. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Stay safe.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.